This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Several companies say they're on the verge of figuring out how to harness nuclear fusion for commercial energy. Nuclear fusion is the same process that powers the sun, and advocates say if scientists are able to make it happen here on Earth on a large scale, it could be an effectively limitless source of clean energy. Here's John Kerry, U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change, talking at the United Nations Climate Conference earlier this week.
There is potential in fusion to revolutionize our world and to change all of the options that are in front of us and provide the world with abundant and clean energy without the harmful emissions of traditional energy sources.
Although nuclear fusion would be a big deal, there's still a long way to go. The current record for a controlled nuclear fusion reaction on Earth is just 8 minutes. We're talking about the possibility of using nuclear fusion as a source of clean energy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the development, the research on fusion power over the years, over the decades? Are you hopeful that it could be a practical source of energy, maybe in our lifetimes? What questions do you have about how it works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kerry Forrest is a professor of physics and director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison. He's co-founder of Rialta Fusion, a Madison-based startup. Kerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Can you give us the basics of what fusion is and how it works?
Fusion is a nuclear process by which light atoms such as hydrogen come together, fuse, and produce heavier atoms like helium and give off energy through a change in their overall mass, just as Einstein predicted.
Now, we've been working
to do that. To make that happen, you have to get the nuclei of those atoms close enough to each other that the nuclear forces can take over from the electric forces that keep them apart. And that requires really hot, energetic temperatures such that the reactions take place like they do in the sun. The sun's quite hot, 100 million degrees, and that gives the particles enough average energy that they're able to overcome that electric propulsion and fuse together and give off their nuclear energy.
And that's the challenge, as I understand it, trying to get something like those middle of the sun conditions to happen on Earth in a controlled and sustained way. And this is why it's been something that we've been researching for quite a while, right? Trying to meet those challenges.
Indeed, that's the big challenge. We know how to make those conditions. We can put energy into a gas and heat it up using things like microwaves and so forth. But the difficulty is insulating it from the cold surrounding matter that we have here on Earth. And so that insulation, you can heat something to a very high temperature if you can somehow insulate it. So we have different ways of doing that. One is to use magnetic fields configured in a certain way using electromagnets to build a bottle, a thermos bottle, if you will, using those magnetic fields to keep the hot gas off of the cold walls.
Now, and as I understand it, there are a couple different main methods that people are using. Loosely, there's the laser method and there's the magnetic containment method, or tokamak, I think is how they say it. Can you explain the basics of those two approaches?
Sure. So the laser method, the idea is that we can use for a very, very short period of time the inertia, if you will, of the material itself to hold it in place long enough for the fusion to take place. So lasers are used to heat the gas, turn it into a plasma, and make it dense enough that the fusion essentially ignites, much in the way an H-bomb might ignite, and give off a very small but controlled explosion of energy that consumes up the fuels of hydrogen and gives off the fusion energy. Harnessing that would be a big challenge. The other technique, and perhaps the more likely to be commercialized, although I wouldn't want to put my finger on that scale at this moment, would be to use magnetic fields we create magnetic fields in, you know, using electromagnets, and we have different geometries. The geometry that's most common is called a tokamak geometry. It was invented in the Soviet Union in the 1960s, and it creates a donut-shaped magnetic field that particles travel around, orbiting around the magnetic field lines, if you will, and the field lines never touch surfaces, so the particles never cool off.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter's with us in Stoughton. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon. I think people, well, you just mentioned a date, but I think people should keep in mind that this isn't some newfangled idea. As far back as 1990, I built the cryostat and annulus for a plasma fusion reactor that was a collaboration between MIT and Lawrence Livermore Labs. And it was even interesting back then to, okay, this might be the next step. This might be the next step. And here we are all these years later, getting to the next step. And I'm hoping I live to see this become successful.
Peter, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And Carrie, I think there's a running joke that plasma is always 10 years in the future, no matter your starting point, which is kind of unfair because, as Peter points out, there has been research, there have been developments. We're inching closer and closer. Can you talk about the horizon for sustainable, usable fusion energy potentially?
Absolutely. I often tell the story that in the mid-90s, you know, I was working in mainstream fusion tokamak world, and I had a decision to make, which was what I was going to do with the next 20 years of my life. And there was a device being built in the south of France called ITER, and it was only going to have its first plasma starting in the mid, you know, in 2016 or something like that. And it wasn't even going to demonstrate fusion conditions until the early 2020s. And that was so far away at the time. I basically decided to work more on plasma astrophysics questions rather than working on nuclear fusion research because it just seemed so far in the future. But a lot has changed even in the last decade that can give us some hope. And so in addition to the fact that things have gotten bigger and more expensive to build, which is the main thing slowing things down at this stage, the progress in fusion energy production, as measured by gain, if you will, made rapid progress, sort of faster than the progress made on packing semiconductors onto chips for computers. The progress was enormous, but then it stalled out because the next steps became too expensive to build. And that's part of the problem. So the companies that are starting now are using ways to reduce the size and cost of the reduce the size and complexity of the fusion systems. One way to do that is to use much stronger magnets than were possible even a decade ago. There's a new generation of superconducting magnets that allows us to build magnets at least twice or more stronger fields than was even possible a decade ago. And in Boston, for example, there's a company called CFS that's working on that project. And we're also hoping to use those high field magnets here on a simpler concept called a mirror to make it work.
Carrie Forrest is with us, professor of physics, director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison, talking about the possibility of nuclear fusion as a clean energy source in the future. Big question, how distant future are we talking about? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Carrie just mentioned private companies getting in the game. Say they're getting closer to creating nuclear fusion energy that could be hooked up to the power grid at some point. Are you hopeful? Do you have questions about how this will work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison physics professor Carrie Forrest about the possibility of nuclear fusion as a clean energy source. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your hopes, your worries, your questions about nuclear fusion as a potential source of clean energy? What do you know about how it works? What do you want to know? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with John in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question on how are you harnessing the energy that's coming out of this fusion? Are you running electrons through a magnetic field, or is it just the old standard heat up water and turn turbines that way?
That's a great question, John. We produce that nuclear fusion energy. How do we turn it into electricity that we can use?
Absolutely, great question. So the energy can be harnessed in several ways, and the most straightforward is just to heat up a liquid. But maybe you're not going to heat up a liquid like water, as in a fission reactor. Maybe you would be heating up a liquid metal. Maybe it would be lithium or lead lithium, and that would be coming out at a much higher temperature than you would have, say, with water. And so that heat could be used for different things. It could be used to drive a turbine, very high efficiency turbine, to make electricity. But you might also use it to produce things commercially by using the process heat directly. And there are plenty of places where we can impact our fossil fuel usages by using the process heat directly. We also have so systems like tokamaks, that would almost certainly be the case, that you'd be heating up a blanket of molten metal or salt or something like that. But then there are other open systems where you might harness the outflowing plasma energy and turn it into a current and a DC power source, if you will, and harness it directly. That's much more efficient in principle if you're going to produce electricity. So both are options, and it's a great question.
Yeah, John, thanks a lot for calling in with that question. I want to talk a little more about time horizon. Now, we had Special Envoy John Kerry talk about this at a climate change conference. Now, maybe if we have fusion power and that's the standard in 100 years, great. Talking about it at a time scale that can affect our current concerns about climate change in the next 10 to 12 years, are we worried about putting a lot of eggs in that basket that may not hatch in time?
Well, I certainly know that the goal is to have major increases in both fission and fusion by 2040 in order to have a big impact on climate change. So that's kind of on the horizon that you're talking about. And that's where most of the commercial entities that are popping up are promising, you know, to have demonstration reactors on the 10-year time frame and then a commercialization that comes shortly thereafter.
Now, people may think about nuclear energy and think about nuclear fission, the nuclear power we have now, and think about, you know, the waste and the long-running questions about what we do with waste from nuclear power plants. Is that a concern with nuclear fusion? I mean, if we're just making helium, are we all cool with waste?
Yeah, so it's there are it's a nuclear process. The most of the energy from the easiest to harness fusion reactions come out in the form of neutrons. The neutrons can interact with the material around the plasma that hold the thing together, that make up the vessels and so forth. And those can create new radioactive elements that have some half-life that need to be dealt with when the fusion reactor shuts off. And so there's a huge amount of research right now to find the perfect material to go around a fusion system and to make sure that those radioactive byproducts are very short-lived and don't require the long-lived places, you know, like Yucca Mountain to hold them later on. The volume is also a thing. We don't want very much of that. And so maybe we can recycle those walls and go into a system where the waste is reduced further. So a lot of that has to be fleshed out.
I want to talk about some of the wow stuff now, Carrie. What kind of temperatures are we talking about here to sustain a usable fusion reaction?
Yeah, so 100 million degrees. That's about 10 times the temperature of the core of the sun. And in order to do it here on Earth, we don't have the advantage of size and gravity. So we use magnetic fields to hold those enormous pressures in place rather than gravity by using magnetic fields. And the temperature needs to be higher because, again, we'll have a core that's burning and we'll have a cold edge, which isn't. And in order to get significant amount out, we have to go to even higher temperatures than the sun.
And briefly, as I understand it, we're creating plasma, not the part of our blood, but the state of matter that can occur at these kind of temperatures.
Sure.
And part of the problem, just in our last minute or so, Carrie, is plasma is kind of hard to predict and we don't get to play with it very much. How big a challenge is that?
That's a huge challenge. But one of the things that really helps us there is that the speed with which computers can now keep up and actually calculate, you know, where all the particles are going that make up the plasma, the charged particles and so forth, has increased so much in the last 60 years that we can almost model every particle in the computer, track its orbits, and predict what would happen without having to understand at a more fundamental level. So computation is allowing us to design these systems, you know, in the computer before we build them, and that's much cheaper.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Carrie Forrest, professor of physics and director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison. He talked to us to look at some of the latest news on nuclear fusion, a big topic at that big climate conference, the international one you may have been hearing about, looking at the latest research on nuclear fusion and how it could be used as a clean energy source in the maybe not too distant future. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been a wide variety of radio stations on the airwaves over the years. Commercial, music and talk, public radio, community stations, and going back to the beginning, radio broadcasting run by colleges, universities, and their students. From early experimental stations, including 9XM here in Wisconsin, campus radio stations evolved and at many points became really influential, even past the boundaries of their campuses. In addition to providing unique music, news, and talk programming on the airwaves, college radio stations have often found themselves on front lines of public debates around education, media, culture, and politics. In her new book, our next guest digs deep into the stories behind college radio. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you listen to college radio as a teenager or while you were in college yourself? Do you still listen to college radio today? What made or makes that special? And were you involved in creating radio on a campus station at some point? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catherine Rye Jewell is a professor of history at Fitchburg State University in Massachusetts. Her new book is called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You've got your own left of the dial college radio story. How did you get involved in college radio?
I do. So I started college radio fresh out of the gate as a first-year student at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. I started in 1997. I actually had no idea that student-run radio was even possible when I got there. I'm from Vermont, and the only college radio station I could pick up was the Dartmouth station, and it was a commercial station, and students really weren't in charge. But I went by the student activities table, saw that there was this radio station, and somehow, some way, they let me on to this 19,000 watt radio station that reached Metro Nashville.
And what inspired you to write this book now, digging deep into the story behind not just that college radio station, but about the concept of college radio even?
Yeah, so I'm a political historian, so I'm interested in regulations and the politics of culture in the 20th century. But in 2011, my alma mater's station was one of a spate of sales where the university decided that radio was no longer this thing that they thought that was valuable for their students to be involved in, at least in a so-called terrestrial radio signal. They still have an online radio station that students can participate in, but they sold their FM signal. And so the historian in me started thinking, well, what is it that we're losing and where did it come from? How did this thing of student-run college radio with this particular role in the music industry that I came to appreciate it for, where did that even come from? How did students get on the air to begin with? And I started looking around and no one had written that history from a national perspective in conversation with the idea of public radio and the regulations behind educational radio that give us a lot of these non-commercial signals on the left side of the dial.
Tell us a little bit about this FM range and this rise of, I think, what we now think of as college radio.
Yeah, so college radio goes back to the beginning of radio itself, that a lot of experimental stations in electrical engineering departments and student clubs were right there at the very beginning of radio, well before the 1920, you know, kind of first commercial broadcast of radio. And it goes through a bunch of different permutations over time, sort of in conversation with how Congress was looking to regulate the airwaves. We get that educational non-commercial set aside in the 1940s, but FM doesn't really take off until the 1960s when you could, you know, get a receiver that where you would get both. And it's at that moment that universities realize that there is value to their educational missions in getting students on the airwaves, to give them professional experience of broadcasting, but also to create these cultural links between universities and the communities, to provide a access point for people around the university to hear what's going on at the university through events or concerts or lectures, but also to have access to the kinds of cultural interests that students had going on. And students really pushed for there to be representation of the kind of music that they were really excited about on these airwaves. So if all these different people coming to college radio with a certain mindset of, you know, here's how it can help us with this particular goal. So there's a lot of voices that shape college radio from the outset, and in particular, since the 1960s.
And all those different voices, there's a tension between them all in almost all the examples you give versus between, hey, we should sound like a professional commercial level station versus let's have fun and be amateurs and learn, or we're serving students, or we're serving the wider community, or we want music that's not on other stations, or we need to do underrepresented sporting events. You can't do all of those. And it seems like that creative tension is always bubbling there.
Yeah. And some of it just relates to the physics of radio, and there's only 168 hours in a week. And, you know, that this is before digital radio. So there weren't multiple signals that people could, you know, divide up and have different types of service on. So that alone limits what stations could do. And your listeners will probably be familiar with the block format, which distinguished these stations from commercial stations, which tended to use a more of a day parting schedule of, you know, you'd have morning drive time and, you know, sort of easy listening maybe during the day for work. College stations tended to divide up the schedule around all of those different claimants. But the thing is particularly, and this is where the regulatory political piece comes into it, as deregulation starts to affect media, starting in really in the 1980s, those non-commercial stations become some of the few places that communities could go to for service. And there's all of these market pressures on universities to kind of prove their worth. And radio was a place where they could do that, both educationally and in broadcasting the benefits of the university to wider communities. And so the stakes become a lot higher. And so these stations become a real crossroads over culture and whose voice gets to be heard, you know, and backed up by the institutional investment of these institutions that are sort of interested in bigger things than what, you know, is going to be the next big hit and the next sort of driver of the commercial music industry.
Talking to Catherine Rye Jewell about her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Alicia joins us now, called from here in Wisconsin. Alicia, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to participate in this broadcast.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm original from California. In 1992, I've started working at Capital Public Radio, which was a college radio station that became National Public Radio sister station. And it was a really fun, incredible time that I had there, because at the time, I don't know if you remember.
Oop, we're losing your signal there, Alicia. I'm so sorry, but thanks for sharing that experience. And Kate, speaking of tensions, there was another tension between NPR and some college stations, and within college stations, should we air NPR content? Should we try to sound more like NPR? Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. So a lot of NPR signals get, or stations as we think of them now, get their start on college signals. And that was part of the deal in creating the Public Broadcasting Act under, you know, the Lyndon Johnson administration that gave us public television as well. In the 1970s, though, there's a bit of a split that takes place between stations that go the public broadcasting route, which tended to air more syndicated content, news and information, and syndicated cultural programming versus the student-run kind of educational stations. But the thing is that there's no clear, bright line between the two of them. And at a lot of stations, they would air maybe NPR news and information in the morning or in the evening, and then they would switch back to student-run radio during the day or community-run shows. And a lot of tension sprung up over, do we expand those hours? Do we bring in more professional staff and have the students be interns, while at the same time understanding that that gave students a lot of really fantastic professional experience? You know, so what's the better educational experience? Giving them new experience on a news and information program behind the scenes, doing the work of a producer, or being on air themselves and picking the music and crafting their own show? And I would argue that both of those things have educational value, but it's really hard to do both of those things on the same station. And so over time, you see a lot of really big, very tense battles over whether or not stations are going to kind of go NPR.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Catherine Rye Jewell, Associate Professor of History at Fitchburg State University. Her new book is Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. You can join in with your own experiences, your stories, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from a bunch of you there. Some shout-outs to stations. Glenn gives a shout-out to WGBW in Green Bay. Dave has WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts. James says he was a DJ at WWSP in Stevens Point in the mid-2000s. And James says, I've been playing in their famous annual trivia contest since 1991. Keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a 1985 song by The Replacements called Left of the Dial. That term Left of the Dial refers to non-commercial radio that airs on a reserved band, the FM spectrum. That includes college radio, our topic now with historian Catherine Rye Jewell. Her new book is called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I have an odd question. So I know in radio for a long time, back in the old days of radio, there was this big push to not play what the young people wanted because it was too subversive. But then, according to this, we have young people, like, playing their music, whatever they want, on a college radio station. Was that seen as kind of contradictory, or did culture change, or did something happen where maybe we couldn't play young people's music again at some point? That's what I was curious about.
Nick, thanks for the call. Kate, you spend a lot of time talking about the music that ends up on college radio stations and a whole genre, college rock, coming out of this.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about this idea of the role that college radio plays in youth culture and bringing youth culture up to the level where it can influence what we might think of as mainstream culture. And the idea of the subversive music is something that is very much at the heart of the book. And, you know, what the idea of maybe obscene music or indecent music, and that is a kind of political or legal concept, is something that's really malleable throughout these years. And you tend to see the courts resorting to, right, what local preferences are when it comes to determining what gets allowed on the airwaves or not. And the bar for obscenity tends to be really, really high. And in all of the research I did, there's only one station that lost its license for technically for obscenity. But really, it was because the administration kind of forgot it had a radio station and just wasn't managing it. And that was WXPN at the University of Pennsylvania in the 1970s. But there was an incident where the PMRC, your listeners might remember Tipper Gore and the hearings in 1985, with Dee Snider from Twisted Sister and John Denver and Frank Zappa kind of squaring off over the content of music. But the thing is that those debates kind of really weren't about radio, because they were already governed by the FCC and there were already guardrails on what could be played or not. Really, those debates were about labeling music so that consumers could make a, you know, kind of informed choice. But the PMRC does get involved in one radio station at the University of California at Santa Barbara. So a student there complained about what was going on. It went all the way to the PMRC and they got the FCC involved. And they did get a little slap on the wrist, a reprimand, not a fine. But what it tells us is that we see this idea of the culture wars and the content of music becoming more nationalized in the 1980s. So what's going on in an individual station is no longer being seen through the lens of local media and local cultures, but rather through this kind of national idea of the culture wars. And these stations and college students get kind of swept up into that in this one really remarkable case. But for the majority of stations, they're really fearful about getting caught, because these are small stations, they have small budgets. If they get fined, it's probably more than their annual budget. And so there's this kind of chilling effect that happens across stations where they're really careful about what they're going to play. They might reserve the most challenging content for maybe after 10 p.m., the so-called safe harbor hours.
Thanks for that call. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. I don't know how long I'm going to have you, so I'll make this real quick. I was in high school. Our high school had a radio station in Green Bay back in the 70s. I actually held a third-class radio telephone operator's license. But I remember, having to watch what music we played. You know, you couldn't play anything controversial. Pretty much anything that we got for free. You know, we all hustled for music. And I still remember to this day, I don't know how many people really know about it, but the original album cover from Queen, Day at the Races, was X-rated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that. So that was a high school station even, but Kate, you talked to a lot of people who had done college radio. I hear a lot of joy from Pat in thinking about the memory. Did you encounter that a lot?
Absolutely. This tends to be one of people's most favorite memories, most cherished memories. And there's something sort of magical about speaking into a microphone in this little room. And, you know, for those people who maybe participated in college radio, these weren't always like the fanciest studios. They usually had some kind of smelly couch and covered in stickers. You know, so you're in this little room sequestered, but you're talking out to the mic and you're reaching people in really intimate ways. And, you know, you're in their car with them, you're in their living room with them. And for somebody to be able to put together a slate of music that really speaks to a listener is a really fabulous kind of connection. I think that's really at the heart of the sentiment that we have towards these experiences. And in high school and college, I talked to a lot of people who had done radio in high school, and it's you know, just as valued and oftentimes was just as influential as some of the college stations. That artists wanted to get their music on the high school stations as much as they did on the college stations.
Talking to Catherine Rye Jewell about her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. We asked around here at WPR about college radio experiences. Not surprising. Got a lot. Here's an audio one from our own Trina LaSousa.
I was very involved at the college student radio station, WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. And I truly loved my experience in college radio. I had the opportunity to be the lead talk show host and lead producer of Earthspeak Radio, which was an environmental talk show. And I also got to host my own positive vibes reggae music show. And I really think it inspired me for my current career in radio today.
And that speaks, Kate, to another role you look at. College radio is a training ground for people who went on to work in media, TV, musicians, people in the music industry. It was also a job training for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, stars from Tom Morello in Rage Against the Machine. He still has a radio show on Sirius XM. Music writers coming out of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There would oftentimes be these links and, you know, networks that people were able to follow into radio, into broadcasting from their college radio station. But at the same time, even those of us who didn't necessarily envision a career in broadcasting got so many benefits from it. You know, I'm a college professor, and I think one of the reasons that I'm so capable of standing up in front of a room of the toughest audience in the world of college students and being able to teach is my experience on college radio, that it kind of broke through a lot of the fears that I had about either just public speaking, but also being able to find my voice. You know, and I always quote Chuck D from Public Enemy, who is a college radio DJ at WBAU and on Long Island and at Adelphi University. And he always says that college radio is what helped him find his voice as an artist and to figure out what it was he really wanted to say.
Kate, under a minute for a big question. Your hopes for the future of college radio?
College radio is alive and well, despite stations like mine having been sold. It is still very possible to get on the airwaves, both for college students and community members. It doesn't have the same role in the music industry that it used to. But the thing is that college students and community members are really creative, and they are going to figure out something exciting to do with these stations that goes way beyond just music discovery.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Catherine Rye Jewell, professor of history at Fitchburg State University in Massachusetts. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio, and hearing some of your stories about listening to or DJing at college radio stations. You can keep sharing your memories or what you're doing right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, two members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation join the show for a look at U.S. policy in Gaza. We'll hear from one from each party. And this week's edition of Food Friday is a great one for this state and for this time of year. We'll get advice on making amazing cheese boards and relish trays and other great food displays for entertaining during the holidays or any time. You can get started right now. Do you have a magical secret to share about how to make the perfect cheese board for company? Let us know right now. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.